Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Are we rolling?
That's it.
All right, I'm going to interject with another song here. Before I play it, I'll tell you, sometimes I write songs in my dreams. I guess everybody does. I don't know. Maybe they don't.
Who knows?
Sometimes I write them about my dreams. Sometimes those two things intertwine. And in the recent past, I was asleep, and I heard someone call for me, mm-hmm. and to wake me from my slumber. And it was real. I heard the door open, heard him call me. Anyway, and I woke and I went looking for him. I called back, but they were not there. Mm-hmm. I guess it turns out I was dreaming. I was dreaming the call for me. And I also had a melody. I had words. I had an overflowing of things. And like is my custom, every day of my life mostly, in all my quiet moments, you know, I can't stop. I don't know why. I sat down and took a pen to paper and I wrote this song, and this is kind of a callback to a dream. So I can't say this was formed. Some of the times I'm dreaming and I write a whole song in my dream, or it's inspired in a dream, and I wake up and I just dictate it. Mm-hmm. And I got a few of these in this pile here. But without further ado, as I might say on stage, whenever I'm fortunate enough to be there, here's a song. Here's a song I wrote. I hadn't really titled it. But here we go. Call my name, girl, and don't make it a whisper, 'cause I've been too long a drifter out here riding on the range. Don't be ashamed of my wild hair and my blisters, and my gun hand when it trembles. Every time I smell the rain, I get tired out here walking across the streets with all the strangers. Ever braced against the dangers at the raising of the day. The days are long if I'm not careful. Well, I'll kill off all your memories, and the cost won't soon forgive me, and I'll have to take the blame, take the blame, take the blame. 'Cause it burns me like an ember, and it takes me down to cinder, and it blows me right away, right away, right away. You can find me out here wailing, mostly light and heavy laden, with the things that I won't say, and I won't say, I can't say. What will come of me tomorrow, but I hope that it ain't sorrow, and I hope that we can stay, we can stay, we can stay. Oh, together for a moment, and I hope that I ain't dreaming when you call out my name, call my name, call my name. Girl, and don't make it a whisper, 'cause I've been too long a drifter out here riding on the range. Don't be ashamed, don't be ashamed of my wild hair and my blisters, and my wild heart when it trembles every time you call my name.
Right on.
We got another one. We got another song there. We just got one. So yeah. That's two we got.
That's two. Let me get you set back up for talking.
Yeah. And I'd like to say thank you for the capo. I borrowed a capo for that one.
Yeah.
And I don't even know why I capoed it. But capos escape me. Like, every time I get a capo, I don't know what happens to it. Yeah, I mean, your capo's here. It's safe.
Yeah.
For the moment. But
they run.
I know in the old days, my friends and fellow musicians used to accidentally appropriate them. You know, they borrow it. It goes on their headstock. It goes home. So I started carving my name in them. And I did that with sound hole covers, too, back when I used to think you needed a sound hole cover. And sometimes now, even now, I'll be around a musician who I used to know 20 years ago, and they'll be playing with a capo, and they'll have my name carved in it. And I just take great joy in that. I don't take the capo back. I'm like, that capo. And it, what amazes me is...
That was 10 capos ago.
For me, it was 20 capos ago, but for them, it's the one capo that they have had since they lifted it off of me.
Yeah.
And I even lifted one of myself a time or two and on accident, but from a few good musicians. And but I carved their name into it. And it got lost. So somewhere out there, there are capos with other musicians' names carved into them that other people have lifted. But I was the instrument of that.
Well, man, just to go back into the story and just to go back to your mother for a while. And a fairly interesting story about how your mom and dad met. The old How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah. So my dad had just got back from Vietnam. All right. He was drafted and went to Vietnam in 1966. He was a CB. Mm-hmm. And he was never been in the military in his life. And they drafted him. They brought him down there. And interviewed him. He went down there and they understood what his experience in construction was, and they made him an E-5 mm-hmm. on the first day. Like, he went to Vietnam as an E-5, having never been in the military, to tell you how good he was at what he did as a construction person.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets, let me tell you what. We could talk about... I don't know if we got time to talk about some of the Vietnam stories. I'm sure we got all the time. We won't. But let me just skip way past some of that. And when he got there, another E-5 came up to him. And he says, Sharp, your duty today is to go take the... I don't say it on the radio, but you know, they had these barrels full of waste, human, you know. And they burnt these. This is what they did with them to get rid of them. He says, your job today, first day, is to go and burn all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad says, he's a pretty smart guy. He says, no. He says, that's what you're doing today. He says, no. A guy says, no, I outrank you. And dad says, no, I'm an E-5. He says, yes, but I've been an E-5 for 5 years. And dad says, yeah, well, I got mine. Or he says, I'm an E-5 too, and I've been in the Navy for 5 years. Dad says, well, I got my E-5 the day before you got yours because I checked the paperwork before I got out here. So you go burn it.
Ooh.
And this is the nature of telling you a very little bit about my dad's personality. And I said, what happened? He said, I don't know if he burned it or not. I didn't care. He says, but I can tell you that I never saw him again the entire time I was in Vietnam. Never laid eyes on that guy.
Ooh.
And anyway, dad got home from Vietnam. He made it. He was the first veteran that returned to this county from Vietnam alive. Now, he was the first living one that came back.
Mm-hmm.
And he went and was working. He was at the VFW serving. I like to say he was serving drinks, but he'll always correct me and say it was setups. We didn't serve alcohol. We didn't serve booze. I was serving setups.
Mm-hmm.
And Saturday nights, they had a band. And he was out there behind the bar. My mother was... playing in the band. She's, you know, the piano player. And well, they met, and I guess they liked each other. And well, on the breaks, she would come around behind the bar and visit with him.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these nights, I don't know when, some man who was trying to get my mother to dance came up, Patty G, I want you to dance with me. And no, I'm not dancing. He kept on.
He kept on. I want you to dance. And my dad, of course, says to him, says, "All right, Hoss." He used to call you Hoss. When he called you Hoss,
wasn't speaking friendly.
He used to call me Buddy Rowe, and he called me Hoss once in my life. I ain't telling that story. But all right, Hoss. He says, "She don't want to dance with you. You might as well go on." And he says, "The guy did this thing evidently that people used to do, and he did a little dance, boxing dance, and rolled his hands around in front of him, like setting up to do a punch out." Mm-hmm. You know, when my dad was younger, he occasionally might tell this story. He might not. He would do the motion for me. And I later saw this motion. People do this. They instinctively project their intentions with a little hand rolling. It's like when you see somebody in the old Western movies lick their thumb and then get ready to fight. You know, mm-hmm. Why do they do that? Why do they lick their thumb and put it in the fighting sense? He says he rolled his hands at him and he might have said something unfriendly. And well, my dad came all the way over the bar and hit him one time and knocked him out of the building. There was a door behind him. He went all the way out, knocked out, all the way down the stairs, all the way into the yard. Hmm. And nobody touched him. Nobody helped him. It wasn't like maybe today, who knows, you know, that would be something big that happened. You know?
Yeah.
But in those days, we're talking about 1967, mm-hmm. You got knocked out of a bar, you might lay there till you woke up, you know. And evidently he did, because later he was gone. And that's how he met my mama. And, well, Dad was sitting at the local I keep hesitating about telling actual names of landmarks like it's dangerous or something, but he was sitting at Pop's, okay? Pop's used to be the burger joint. And
setups.
Well, they were setups. They really weren't selling alcohol. You know?
Yeah.
They might have had some, and might is a strong word.
It's just nuance. Right?
It's nuance. But, you know, there's a whole later story, that whole deal, the whole VFW thing. I'm interject my own story now. I'm a sideline officer. We, in the last years before this whole thing hit, you know, everybody shut down, we the guild, whole nother story, went out there and played a bunch of gigs. We started playing at the VFW again because it's been basically musically unused for many, many, many years. And I decided, I was like, I'm going to go play. And that's not the first time. My first time was like right after high school in my first band. I went and did a VFW gig and booked it and brought my band. And it was cool. And that's a whole nother story. And there's a particular veteran I'd like to call out if we're sneaking in. And he's probably still guilty. He didn't pay his fee. He wrote his number on his hand. Now I really went four levels past the story. So Dad was sitting at Pop's next afternoon after he knocked this guy out the door. And I didn't even tell you the whole story about that. There's some parts I can't tell of that. Or I won't. And he's sitting there and this car wheels up beside him. And by the way, before this, everybody around town had told him, said, "Bobby Glenn, so-and-so, whoever he was, he can tell you, it don't matter now, he's probably dead. So-and-so is a bad man. And we know you done knocked him out the door, knocked him out. You ain't getting away with this. Mm. You better be prepared for something, okay? He's coming. He's going to come, you know.
Retribution.
Do what he's going to do." That's it, and it pops. In his car, windows rolled down. Well, here comes this fella in his car. He wheels up beside him with his window down, slid to the side, and Dad said he just reached over in the passenger seat there and got a hold of his poker gun. Whole nother story. We talked about this song right here in front of me about the poker gun. And he got a hold of it and, well, guess, you know, whatever. I don't think the guy saw it. I don't know. I'm sure he didn't, because my dad never would have touched it if he wasn't going to use it. And he said, the guy says, "Are you Bobby Glenn Sharp?" He says, "I am." He says, "Well, I want to apologize to you." He said, I was rude last night and you knocked me out of that building. He says, and I deserved it. And I just want to tell you, I'm sorry.
Hmm.
And my, yeah.
You never expect us to go that way.
You never do. Maybe somebody done told him. Maybe somebody done been around at his house and said, buddy, this fella just got back from Da Nang.
Yeah.
All right. And maybe somebody done told him about some things I ought not talk about, you know, that says, all right, no problem, bud. It's all right. Okay. And he rolled on out of there, and that was the story of the end of that fight right there. I've combed the woods on occasion around the VFW in the direct area that I was told that there was some nefarious weaponry that was late in the 60s ditched out there. Now I'm going way off. Y'all don't say, oh, it ain't there. Ain't nothing there. You ain't going to find nothing out there. If there was something,
sorry, somebody been
got it or it wasn't there to begin with, because it was a lie. Half the stories people ever tell is embellished in lies to begin with. So my daddy, I ain't never heard him tell a lie. I don't think he's going to tell a lie, but I saw him slap a man or two that was 20 years younger than him in his day for telling a lie. oh, yeah. Anyway, that's the story how so they got married. And then I was born maybe 5 years after that.
So there you go. And so, I mean, just back to you, and I think, I guess we're up to the Oxford days, and I don't want to skip too far ahead, but I think that's where we are on the timeline.
Sure, we can be there. Time is not a line. It's a circle. I don't view it as a line. It's not linear. Time is absolutely not linear. It is a circle. The moment we are existing in right now is the same moment we existed in 10 years ago. And the moment we exist in 10 years from now will be the same moment we're sitting in right now. It is, time is a circle.
I think it rhymes too.
Good.
I don't think it repeats itself. I think it rhymes.
You think that time rhymes or that what I just said rhymes?
Both. More of the second.
I think, you know, I've always thought that. I've always understood that a moment isn't forever. A moment isn't forever. And it actually never happened. All at once. It is fleeting. Every day we wake is another day for the potential of anarchy in our lives.
Absolutely.
And that is just what happens. I mean, I don't want to say people because I can't speak for nobody. I've come to understand that I only speak for me, and even me speaking for me is not the same me that was here yesterday, yet it is. And every day you may think something is going to go a certain way. You may try every way you can to control every action that you do, to curb every word and phrase and every action that you do, and promise you.
You'll drive yourself nuts.
Not only that, it ain't going to happen, buddy. Ain't none of it going to be constant. There are no constants. There are no constants. As much as you want to make a constant. I've been, you know, I used to have a code. I used to have a code that I lived by. It was clear. It was cut and it was dry and it was a representation of my dad's code. I was taught that code. And I touched on earlier that I went to a lot of schools and a lot of different places. And let me tell you, it ain't always easy for the new kid. And I learned about the code of respect. And I let that code color a great part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And the code is flawed. The code is flawed. You cannot take a constant thing that you think about yourself as if this thing happens, then this other thing will happen, or I will feel a certain way about it. You cannot do that. You can, but it's not going to serve you because you're not going to control it. All you're going to control is how many times you fail at it.
That's the thing, is like, you can't control the variables. So how are you supposed to control the outcome?
That's right. Yeah. What you can control is your approach, is the approach.
The only thing is you. That's the only thing you have control over. But everything outside is, you don't know how it's going to react.
I used to be a whitewater raft guide for some seasons.
Oh, here, let's go.
And there's an approach to every rapid, and these rapids will eat you alive. And I don't care. You may have went down a bunch of rivers, and that could, and you might have felt like it was an amusement ride, but I guarantee you that that guide that was taking you down knew how to approach things.
Right.
And once you get into a rapid and you approach it and you get on the wave train, as it's called, there ain't no getting off and then getting through it successfully. Because once you commit.
No, you already bought the ticket. Now you have to take the ride.
Once you commit to a line, there's a line. Once you commit to a line in a river that will take you to a wave or a series of waves across bank to bank, and below those waves is a deep, deep pocket of water with oppressive force on the bottom that unless you've experienced it, you can't explain. But those guys, they're guides, and I did this, they know how to approach a rapid.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? They don't do it the same way every time. But by the time they get on the line, they know what's fixing to happen. And even then, it is unpredictable. And I used to think to myself, some of these older guides have been doing this 30 years, 20 years, whatever, like these guys can do this blindfolded. But every day, like before we would all go down the river, they would, some of them would be apprehensive and nervous. And I didn't understand why, because I'm like, these dudes are like, they're the best. Like, what are they ever going to be worried about? And that was a lesson for me, because I come to understand through my seasons of guiding that there were no guarantees. I don't care what line you took, how many lines you took it. And sometimes the water wasn't going to do what you thought it was. Sometimes the people paddling were not going to do what you thought they were going to do. Sometimes you were not going to do what you thought you would do. And one particular time in this relatively, I call it my nemesis, because I was in that hole a lot. And I finally got to where I could get through it with only me coming out of the boat. and even it was funny, because some of my bros, and there were men and women, you know, guiding, would go in ahead of me and go ahead and set up safety, because they knew that they were going to have to save me at this particular one.
Uh-huh.
And I went through it one time and I came out the back. I finally got my technique down, and I gave that thing so much respect. And I came out the back. And I got pressed directly to the bottom of the river. And I can tell you that if you struggle when you're in one of these holes, well, you might come out, you might not. You may be struggling until the struggle's done. But what you can do, don't quote me on this and don't go try it, you know, because this is about me. You can flatten out calmly and
just let it take you.
And it will float you to the top. You can ball up and it will spit you out the bottom. But if you flail and you kick and you fight, it will wash you like a washing machine. You will get totally ran around.
I mean, let's just back up to Tennessee just for a minute. Just like, I mean, how'd you even get involved with this?
Oh, wow. Well, I knew of someone who I just met, someone who became sort of a river mentor for me, Don. And he came in for something on his off days. The river only ran on, this is a dam regulated river. When the dam is, you know, the dam opens, the river's running.
Yeah.
And when the dam is not open, the river ain't running. And some days the raft companies can take you down the river, and some days they can't. And some days the water flows this. And so there's lots and lots of moving pieces to rivers and guides and boats that you never dream of when you pop on that thing. I always used to say, did you sign your release?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never know what's going to happen. I've got plenty of those stories. But anyway, so I met him, this guide, and tells me these many stories about the river. Now, I had been canoeing for a lot of my life, and I was a boater. Mm-hmm. I had a canoe. Did I have a canoe? I bought a canoe later on the way to a Willie Nelson concert for $200. It's the one sitting right out there. It's a 1970s Carmichael racing canoe, fiberglass. It's fine. But he tells me about the river. And he says, we're training guides right now. And he says, and you, after talking to me, I was sort of burly, big beard, long hair. He was a musician also, has a great album. And he says, you can come and train, and you could be a guide. And here's great stories and everything. And I says, well, when's this thing happening again? He says, well, Thursday. You know, this is a Tuesday. Thursday, you know, show up. You know, we'll train you. I was like, really? Sure.
That easy.
So, okay. Well, forgot all about it. He forgot all about it. Everybody forgot all about it. I didn't forget about it. I'd already been doing lots of long-distance hiking at the time. I used to go out with a backpack and go for as long as I could into the wilderness with just enough water and food to survive. And that was a great joy for me in those days, is to know that, okay, I'm trailing around, but I'll get back to the river. I used to love to hike because I loved the idea that you could take enough water and enough and a little bit of food and enough knowledge and enough courage. Mm. And for many days, you could hike into the middle of nowhere and enjoy the splendor of nature and hike out, you know, or stay there, whatever. And it was a lesson for me that may not have served me as much as I wanted to, because what I began to realize when I was doing all that hiking was that the lessons that I learned there were that I didn't need all of the things that people need and want to make a life. That in fact, to breathe in and breathe out and put one foot in front of the other, all I needed was some water and a little bit of food.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole idea of, like, there's only three things that a human needs to survive, and those scrape and fight over it, is shelter, food, water. Anything other than that is perception, and it's because someone else told you that you needed that.
It is a value system that you have created, or someone has helped you create, or you've been indoctrinated in. Mm-hmm. And it existed before you showed up, and it will exist long after you're gone. And there were people that will argue with you as long as you want to argue about what is right, about who is working where, about what your job is, what your purpose is. But what I came to understand when on those long, long, lonely walks in the middle of nowhere is that I could be fulfilled in my heart. And, you know, I'll turn around, you don't even really actually need water. If you got a water filter, you can locate water. And it kind of ruined me in a way. And then when I got up to the river, now I get to the river. And I went in to the headquarters of this particular company, to the owner, one of the owners. And I walked right in. It was early in the morning. I said, I'm Daniel Sharp, and I want to be trained to be a guide.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say a word, not a word. He looked right back at me and he says, this is the afternoon, not the morning. He says, show up here at 6 in the morning and we'll train you. And I said, okay. And I turned around and walked out. And as I was walking out, I saw they had this logo for their company. And it might as well have been a caricature of me. And it had the beard and the long hair, yeah, and the brawny person with a guitar. And I didn't have a guitar on my back, but I was a guitarist that, yeah, usually had
and
one.
And he knew that.
Maybe. I don't know. I doubt it. Honestly, I doubt it, because of my friend and what I come to understand is when you put your stamp on a guide, if there's a new guide that's coming to guide and you're like, I rep this person, like I'm going to speak up for this guide, you know, well, 9 times out of 10, I don't care. They're not going to make it. The guides are not going to make it through training. They are not going to be a guide. I come to understand that later. So it was people were very hesitant. I was told I could go, but I don't think I was given any sort of build up.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I saw the picture and I just chuckled. And I showed up at 6 o'clock next morning and I started going down the river.
Mm-hmm.
And getting trained. And the guide program was 2 weeks. And you're supposed to take it. Well, and I guess I excelled fast. I don't know. The truth is, sometimes they need guides. And a week after, I was in my little part of the camp. It was like at the base of this mountain. I had my own little section, had my tent. I'm already good at that. And that same owner rolled up there in his blazer, and he says, Daniel, he says, we need you on the river today to work. And I said, well, I got a week left of training. He says, no. He says, we've been watching you. You can do this. You're going to do this. You're trained, and we need you. We want you today. And I went up there. I mean, I was, you know, Well, and I got, and I'll show you what I didn't tell my guests that it was my ever first time ever.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But,
y'all want some cool facts? Hey, but to go down this dangerous river?
No, but we made
first
it.
First time.
Nobody got, I didn't drop anybody out. We made it. Everybody had a great time. I didn't surf any waves that day because I didn't know how. But I did, the main job was well, to be honest with you, I just followed the other guys. I did what they did. And unknowing to me, there's a trick move around this one particular rock where you spin the boat around. It's quite advanced. Or you can go down the left side, which is quite deadly. So I learned this trick move on my first week, my first day, I don't remember, to spin around this rock and go down this other side. And to this day, that's the way I would go down there, you know. Witch's Hole. All right, when you go up there, if you go down, you ever hear somebody call it Witch's Hole? Well, I'm going to tell something on myself. I've never guided straight through the heart of Witch's Hole. I always went to the right and did a little spin move. So, sorry, anybody that ever hears this, like, I remember that guy. Well, he totally messed this up in Witch's Hole, huh? No, trust me, you wanted to go down the right side.
Yeah, I did you right.
Yeah, that's right. So, how do we get on that? I don't know. I think I brought us into that. We're trying to talk about Oxford.
Yeah, back to Oxford. We got off into that by talking about, I think, taking chances.
Right? Taking chances. We were talking about lines.
Mm-hmm.
Lines in the water.
That's it. That's how we got there.
And Oxford. Where are we going with that?
I mean, just how'd you wind up in Oxford? And, I mean, just some of the characters. I mean, we have, you showed me some great art. I mean, there was a lot of people that you met while you were there.
Okay, yeah, Oxford. Characters. Full of them. It was in those days anyway. It was the late 90s. And I went to Oxford. Fell into a house with a friend of mine, roommate. Great place. Hidden back. Brick house. Red brick house. It was like I would walk to the square. And the first night I was in town, I went up to this upstairs bar, and I had a beer, and someone was struggling out in the hallway trying to hang a car door on a wall. And I walked out and grabbed a hold of my end, and we chained it up. Hey, he says, who are you? I told him who I was. Who are you? I own this place. Well, good. We'll go back in. We're talking a little while. I said, hey, I need a job. You got a job for me? He says, I've got a job for you. Just like that. Oh, I just held him on a car door, you know, truck door. And come on in. I'll start you tomorrow. So I felt like first night, bam, got me a job, cool bar, upstairs. Went in, prep cook, you know. I did that a little while. Worked my way from prep cook around to the front where I was serving food, which I loved. I was fantastic at that. I like to think, I know I was. I took care of my people. And when they needed a bartender, I was a bartender also. And the most important thing about that whole deal is we had music 7 nights a week. Nights a week. That was our deal.
By the way, that's every night.
Yeah, that's every night. And I didn't work every night, but I was there every night. And I saw, and I began to meet every musician in town. Everyone.
Such as Jimbo.
Strangely enough, I didn't meet him through that association. Oh, wow. No, I didn't meet Jimbo through that. I became aware of Jimbo.
Oh.
In Oxford. And I saw Jimbo at other places, but Jimbo actually never played at the place I was at, but I was associated. I mean, the rest of them knew Jimbo, you know. But I didn't actually get to meet him through that particular association. So weird. But one night, it was one evening. Well, the band canceled. And we're talking in the back, and owner says, what are we going to do? Says, the band canceled. We need somebody. And I just offhandedly said, I'll play.
And what?
He says, what? You play? I said, sure, I do. Okay, you got a PA? Yeah. Huh. Well, you ain't let me down yet. Are you sure? I'm sure I will come and I will play tonight. Okay, this was lunch.
Now, how many live shows did you have under your belt at this time?
At this time,
because I mean, we talked high school.
This time, I had many, many shows at this time. But I didn't have very many solo shows at all. I had mostly band shows with people backing me up or me backing with help. You know, mostly always had a group of some kind, at least two or three people. Most always. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to struggle to remember any solo show before that, and I can't. So it could have very well been my first solo show. And there's a great pictures of all this stuff somewhere rolling around. And and as it turns out, that night would also not be a solo show for me. But I thought it might be. So I remember later that night, well, first off, I was rolling around Oxford that afternoon, and someone was playing for tips on the street. And I walk up, and I said, hey, I dig your stuff, something like that. Like, what are you doing? You know? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm jamming right here on the street. And who are you? I'm Moon Pie Curtis. And I said, well, I'm Jeremiah Free. And the reason I said I was Jeremiah Free was when I lived in Hattiesburg many years before, I wrote this song called Jeremiah Free. And I thought to myself, oh, if you're Moon Pie Curtis, then I'm Jeremiah Free. If you're not going to tell me your name, I'm going to not tell you my name. I'm Jeremiah Free.
Yeah.
That's great. He loved that. And I said, I'm playing here tonight.
I still do that today, though, Daniel. It's like someone walk up, introduce, are you Alan Aldridge? Well, that depends.
Right.
What's it depend on? What you've heard.
Right.
Well, not to sidetrack you, but it is that way, though.
I say, I'm playing here tonight. He says, you playing here tonight? I said, yeah. Jeremiah Free is going to be playing right here tonight. All right. And I said, hey, why don't you play? You want to play? You can play with me. We'll do a show here. He says, yeah, man, I'll do a show. All right, well, it's me and you then. Moon Pie Curtis and Jeremiah Free. We're going to play tonight right here at this place.
And what a lineup.
Well, who knew? And I remember going home later that evening and calling my mother and asking her for the third verse of Country Roads. On the telephone. There wasn't no internet.
Right.
And writing it down. I was like, I got a show here and I might have to play this song. You know, she gave it to me. And I did play that song that night. And I showed up. And Moon Pie showed up. And we tuned up. And about that time, the bar started filling up. I mean, it was getting full. By full, this is a small bar.
Oxford Square.
It is a square. By full, I'm talking about 20 people. Yeah, it wasn't like it was 100 people, but about 20 people rolled in. I'm like, oh yeah.
Oh yeah, here we go.
I got this. I was like, they must have done somebody. They done heard about Jeremiah Free. Well, let me tell you what it was. They done heard about Moon Pie Curtis. Moon Pie Curtis already had a following, and he was from Oxford and everything. And he's great. And me and Moon Pie co-showed that. And that was my introduction to play music in Oxford. And I'll be honest with you, I only played one or two originals on the whole night. The whole night. And I don't even play those originals anymore. And one of them was called Blues Come On In. As I walk away, I got my back turned to the wind. Blues come to me just like a long-lost friend. That was how it started out. And I played, and the blues, they carry me away. And the blues, they tell me that you would never stay. Oh, blues, come on in. Weird that I... Oh, Three Decembers. I used to have this song called Three Decembers. Haven't seen you, girl, in near three Decembers. On the wind, your name, I whisper as it reaches in the night.
Three Decembers. I love to play with stuff like that. I want to recycle this. We talked about, like, plagiarizing ourselves.
Ourselves. My mama said you called me sometime late December. But she didn't remember why.
Ooh.
You know, it was one of them songs. I later played that on the radio.
I had and I want to recycle it. Like, this is not verbatim, but it doesn't matter because I'm going to recycle. But it's plagiarism myself. Is girl, I ain't seen you in the month of Sundays. But if I'll be there, if you'll be there, if you'll fuck that up. Girl, I haven't seen you in the month of Sundays, but I'll be at church. If you want to come and find me. Or it was something along those.
Right.
Like, playing on, like... Because, like, Three Decembers and, like... I love playing with time like that, because I think it's like time could be a construct. Like we said, it's not linear. It's a circle.
Yeah.
It's like, so we can talk about time however I see fit.
Right. I later got a hold of a bass player, Eric Deaton. Eric Deaton.
For this show?
No, for more shows, not that show. For more shows, Eric Deaton played bass with Jeremiah Free up at the bar. He was a young kid. I'm talking about young, piercing eyes, blonde hair.
Oh, yeah.
And we became friends. Eric Deaton played bass for our show many times up there. And Eric told me one time, he says, "You want to go to Junior's with me?" I said, "What's Junior's?"
Mm-hmm.
And now you know what Junior's is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Junior Kimbrough's place. And you go there on Sundays. In my circle of time, I'm still going there right now. We're riding.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the truck. So me and Eric Deaton rode out there. And, Eric, of course, you know, if you know Eric's history, he was real tight with all those guys. And that's his story now, not mine.
Yeah.
But Eric was family mm-hmm. at Junior Kimbrough's, literally. He was literally family in those days. And so we went in the back door of the little White House, you know. And, Junior was sitting there in his chair right by the back door. And Eric's kind of quiet, you know. He says, "Hey, you know, it's my friend from Oxford, Daniel Sharp, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And Junior says, "Hey, Danny," he said, "you drink corn?" I honestly didn't know what that meant, what that phrasing meant. And I hadn't ever heard it referred to as corn. "Do you drink corn?" he says.
I'm guessing moonshine.
But I knew... You may guess right. You might be guessing right. And but I knew that I did, no matter what it was.
Right.
This gentleman seemed...
It's Junior Kimbrough.
I didn't know who that was or what that meant either. Had no clue. I just knew that this gentleman asked me if I drank corn. I said, "I sure do."
So the first thing out of Junior Kimbrough's mouth when you met him was, "Do you drink corn?"
That's correct. And I said, "Yes." And he came out of what's known as his ass pocket full of whiskey, you know, with some corn, and he handed it to me. Well, so I took a big old drink of Junior's corn whiskey, and let me tell you what, son, it was something else, and I gave more than I should. It was probably a bigger drink. And I was able to hand it back to him before I let go of a holler and a spin. I spun around on my feet. And evidently, it was the funniest thing that had happened there ever, all day at least, all afternoon probably. And they all laughed about that. You know? And so we made it through our night. You know, we're into the night. You know, I had some Bush beer for a dollar. That was great. There were a few other people that showed up from Oxford, one of which I recognized, and I'll visit him in a minute, but I didn't talk to him that night. And not many people from Oxford that, you know, came. And then about halfway through, Junior had done played several sets, and then R.L. Burnside came in.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Eric, it's like, hey, this is my friend, you know, Daniel from Oxford, to R.L. Burnside.
Yeah.
And he just looked square right at me, looked right in the eye, and put his hand out there. And I shook hands with him. And I don't remember, I was way far in at that point. "Good to meet you," some acknowledgement of some kind, you know, all right.
Yeah.
So I'd just been introduced to Junior and R.L. as a friend of Eric. And R.L., the last thing he did was shake my hand, and he stepped right down, sitting on that chair on the stage. And the next thing out of his mouth was, "Well, well, well."
Mm-hmm.
And then it got deep. And this dude from Oxford, who I hadn't, I kind of knew who he was, worked his way into the middle of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And he started this dance, one of the most unusual dances I'd ever seen, because it looked like a rooster strutting around the yard. He was flapping his arms and cricking his knees and strutting in a dance like a rooster, and everybody loved it. And I'm known to do that dance today. on a certain occasion. I went ahead and took that one.
I caught the rooster.
I may not be known, but I'm known to some. When you break me loose on a dance floor, sometimes things happen. And I got at least 12 moves, you know, and each one independent of the other. And that is one of them, is that particular one. And anyway, well, that night was over, made it back. We went home. It was great. I went out there many times. Some with Eric, some with not. I saw there's plenty of famous people around Oxford. You know, I'm not going to start naming them. But
I mean, in your mind at that time, did you realize that you were stepping into a juke joint or music was real?
I quickly realized that I was somewhere that I'd never been, and somewhere that it was magic. It was
something in there.
It was something in there. It was something extraordinary that I'd never experienced in my life when I heard this music. I heard all those classic songs that we now like to listen to on our record players.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back many times. As a matter of fact, one time I got left out there. My ride left me out there. And I was the last one from Oxford out there. And at this particular time, late in the night, Junior, and there wasn't no RL that night, and Junior done been gone. If he was ever there to begin with, I can't remember. He's probably there that night. I don't know. I didn't know a whole lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I'd been out there. But at this night, I was just some dude from Oxford. You know, I don't have no Eric Deaton out with that night. And I'd done been left. So what I decided to do was gamble at some pool.
Do a little hustle?
Well, I ain't going to call it hustling, but I was going to bet. And I like to play pool. I used to anyway. And I mean, it was something to do besides be standing around being left. I needed to do something.
Right.
And I needed to do it fast.
Yeah.
You know, and you ain't just going to walk out of there. I mean, there's
where are you going to walk?
Where are you going to walk?
You're in the middle of nowhere.
And so I started playing pool. And I started winning. I started making some money. And I ended up, I guess I can talk about this now because it's been so many years and that place ain't there anymore or whatever. You know, you ain't supposed to, everybody knows you ain't supposed to gamble on pool. You ain't supposed to do it. You ain't supposed to drink corn whiskey. It's all these things you ain't supposed to do. But, you know, 23-year-old dude, you know, I started winning. And, I ended up figuring out that you don't get to keep all that money. There's a cut to be given somewhere. And so when that was called for, I gave a cut, you know, to whoever. I ain't saying. And subsequently, I said, but I did formulate a plan as to what I would do. I mean, what I was going to do. And I looked all around, and there was a hill near there, and it was fully wooded.
Mm-hmm.
And if it came to it, I was going to slip away into the night and sleep on that hill. And at the break of day, I was going to hitchhike out of there. But I decided I wasn't going to hitchhike out in the middle of the night. So, but I, you know, that's stupid. I didn't have to do that. I'll tell you why. I in the middle of that, I said, hey, I done been left. I need a ride to Oxford. And I got some gas money. Well, I was provided with someone to give me a ride. I gave them gas money and they took me to Oxford where I needed to go. And that's the end of that story right there.
That is the conclusion of part two of Daniel Sharp. If you haven't done so already, I would ask you to rate and review the show. You can find us on social media, Porch Talk, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can also follow Daniel Sharp. Till next time, with part three.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.